Alrighty, folks.
Welcome back to another episode of the Made to Pray podcast. You're joining us on episode number 72. Thank you to everybody who joined us for our comeback episode last month with Mervyn Gibson from the Orange Order. And we're kind of continuing on a wee bit of that theme tonight with my guests. You can see I'm joined here by David Hume. Now, David, I have a long list of accolades that are, you know, so keep me right here, because whenever I was doing this, I was rehearsing this earlier on and I felt like I was in Rocky 3 or Rocky 4. Do you know when Apollo Creed has all the names, you know, Monty the Count, the Monte Fisto, the King of Sting and all that there. So keep me right here. So David, you're an ex-journalist.
I am.
Yep. Yes, all right. Right. And you were the Director of Services for the Grand Orange Law of Ireland. And you had an important role to play in the development of the Museums of Orange Heritage as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
You're an author, an Ulster Scots historian. And then obviously I haven't mentioned the fact that you're an MBE for the community work that you've done up in Ballycarrick and Lauren. Right, so all great stuff. Absolutely delighted to have you on.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, it's good stuff. I'm just trying to keep on some of the themes that I got when I was talking with Mervyn. And one of the things that had come out of that, David, was around the idea of people not knowing their history and, you know, not being something that's important. And we'll get into that in a wee second. But there's something else that you're working on at the minute as well. You've got a TV series that's in development, haven't you?
Yes, we have had a radio series called The Long and the Short, right, myself and Tim McGarry, coming at history from different angles, different communities,
sure,
backgrounds. So we're making the transition to TV.
Brilliant.
With the series now, so with 4 episodes for BBC One.
Brilliant. Well, we'll have a wee chat about that later as well, then, and make sure that we're good. Well, listen, let's get kicked into things then. So, as I say, we were talking to Mervyn, and there's been a few times on the podcast, even talking to Bondsman and other members of within the community, around this idea of people not being either 100% aware of their history and why that's important, you know, to be aware of. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a wee bit about, you know, that lack of education then within the Protestant community. Why is that important for us? What is that, one, your observation, I suppose, is probably that.
Yeah, no,
is that true?
I mean, I would agree with that observation. You know, over the years I've seen it, I've heard lots of people say it. I served on the Flags and Culture Commission as an independent commissioner, and in our travels around the country, that is a lot of what was said by people who'd come through the state education sector. They just didn't know. They weren't taught their own history. They didn't know it. And I think it's extremely important, first of all, because I had a friend in the United States, and he said, if you don't know where you've come from, then you've no idea where you're going to. Mm-hmm. So it's about an anchor. It's about grounding yourself and understanding your background and your community background and all of that. In terms of why we have the situation we have, I think just, to a large extent, the education system has let down the community.
Right.
I think if you went to when I was in the Grand Orange Lodge, we had an education program. A lot of the schools that took that program up, about 60% at one stage, were from the maintained.
Right, sector, okay,
the Catholic
school, yeah.
And it was very different. That sector was very different to the state sector. And you could see the difference from the young people when you were talking to them.
But, and what was that difference?
Well, the difference is about confidence.
Right.
So if you're learning history, and it may not be the correct history, of course, you know, you're learning that would be an issue that I think there should be a common curriculum for everybody. But if you're learning that and you know all about it and you've gone into it in depth, then you're very confident about it, and therefore you're very confident about who you are and where you come from. And if you meet somebody from another community and they don't know very much at all, then they are going to reflect a lack of confidence, which is a big, big issue. And it's a psychological issue. And it shouldn't, nobody should be feeling a lack of confidence in themselves, first of all, at a personal level. But on a community level, it certainly shouldn't be the case. So I think that the state education system, there was 50 years of a Stormont government. That's the irony of all this.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about unionist misrule and so on for 50 years, but the unionist government of the time did not actually ensure that there's a lot of history taught.
Sure.
About how where we were, effectively, and how we got there. So the state system has followed that route right along.
Right, okay.
That, you know, if you ask people about, you know, the home rule period, about partition, about all of that, people of a certain age just wouldn't know because they weren't taught it in school. It is taught to some extent now, but it is taught in a non-chronological way. So
it's all broken up, isn't it?
It's broken up and dropped in, and it doesn't make any sense in that way. So I think that the education system is certainly at the core of all of this. I also think that, you know, our own community, we have to do something. We have to help ourselves, because there's only self-help around at the moment for this. Uh-huh. The education system isn't going to change it.
Yeah.
I mean, we were in the Flags Commission. There was quite a unanimity, really, over the issue of a history curriculum that could be taught in Northern Ireland.
Right.
And the real obstacle to that happening was really within the education system.
Right, okay.
From the people we spoke to at high levels within the education system, because they were saying, oh, it would take, you know, this is a colossal task. It would take so many years to try and address this and all this. But if you don't start addressing it somewhere, then it doesn't get addressed. So I think, and that's where I think bands have a role perhaps to play, because bands are bringing together a lot of young folk together in these bands. They're interested in their culture and their history. They wouldn't be in the bands if they weren't.
Yeah, sure.
And there's a potential there for bands to try and teach a little bit about the history.
Yeah. But as you, there's probably almost even then a lack of people with the right amount of knowledge, I suppose, or resource in order to be able to carry that through. I know that in some bands, you know, some people, there's a number of characters who are well up in their history, and you know, they'll talk to anybody about it, and it can be very engaging. But there's a lot of bands where just that's not the case, and some where they may not even know where to go to even connect with someone to get what may be the right slant on this, you know, for us.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. And it's not an easy win, effectively. Yeah. I mean, the Grand Rounds Lodge had one of the things I'd devised when I was there was an education programme called Educating Ourselves, which looked at the sort of core issues of the Battle of the Boyne and all of that period that people would be interested in but might not know enough about. So we did, we took that out and about, but we had the same problem that there was maybe only two or three people who could actually then teach that. And that is an issue. But there's, I do think, you know, I'm involved with, have been involved with tour guiding and so on over the years. And there's an awful lot of people who train to be tour guides, to do level twos or whatever, and that. So there's nothing to stop people in our community actually getting to this information and getting to this knowledge. If we could get, you know, people that would, a core of people who would put together and say, well, here's what, you know, you could look at.
Yeah.
So you can't teach the whole of the history of the place, you know, over 1,000 years or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But
you
can teach, but particularly I think it's very important for people to know, how did Northern Ireland come about? Why did it come about?
Yeah.
So that's a much easier thing, because that can be distilled down quite a bit more.
Yeah. And I suppose that contested aspect then comes into that, because it gives a sort of the background as to where a lot of the issues that we face in the community and in the province as a whole really come from.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's important to understand the whole dynamics of that home rule period.
Yeah.
You know, one community would look at it and say, well, that was just the prods put the you know, the anchor down, they wouldn't give an inch type thing, and we ended up with partition because of it and all that. And the other side, it would be, well, why were unionists so opposed to the idea of home rule? And they were opposed for a number of very good reasons. One was that they feared they would become a persecuted minority in Ireland, because it would be dominated by the Roman Catholic Church at the time. So that was a big fear, because people tend to look at, you know, look at Northern Ireland and say, oh, unionist majority, but they don't think about it the other way around. Protestant minority in Ireland. What did that mean in the 1900s? And people had a lot of concerns about that.
I suppose that, but that did play out though, to some degree. I mean, those fears weren't unfounded, to some degree, David, because the existence of the Protestant community and what became the Republic would almost say, well, we were right to fear that.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, that's absolutely right, that the population decline, the Protestant population decline in the Irish Free State was very dramatic. And there was around, I think, over 40,000 people who moved across the boundary when it was created. But it was a very dramatic decline. You had a whole issue over, well, it was essentially over mixed marriages and the Moray Decree in 1911. Came to fruition in Belfast, where you had this row and children who were from a mixed marriage had to be brought up as Catholics, according to the Catholic Church at that time.
Okay.
That had an impact, not so much here, not so much in Belfast, but a bigger impact on places like Donegal and Monaghan, sure, and those sort of places.
Yeah, where there was a bigger collection in terms of the population.
And, and that's an issue, and I think that's an issue. To be fair, I think, you know, people who are balanced in view of this will see that that was, you know, something that was valid.
Yeah.
That people had these concerns. And there was also economic concerns as well, too. I mean, Belfast was the powerhouse, of course, industrially. It's where the Industrial Revolution had taken place. And they were concerned that whenever there was a parliament set up in Dublin, if it had taxation powers, that most of those taxes would fall in the north, around Belfast, because that's where the economy was booming. And so the irony would be that they would end up having to pay for Home Rule and they didn't even want it, type thing. So, and of course, Harland Wolff said that once Home Rule passed, they would move across to the Clyde entirely.
Sure.
So, you know, there's all those, and those are all very important issues.
Yeah. And it's ironic that there's a similar kind of feeling today and not there. You know, the economic thing is definitely a play there. And I suppose the other thing that for me also exists, maybe in the Republic as well, is that there's also maybe for the remnant of the Protestant community that lives there, that there's still an element of fear around the expression of their culture there. I know they've talking to some families that would live in sort of in the Navan direction and stuff as well, and they have their orange memorabilia in a locked room that they don't want anybody to even know that it's there and stuff. So there's still a very real sense of, listen, we're not 100%.
And I think that's the difficulty, and you know, and to some extent, both states after partition reflected the religious aspects, and as far as the people that were involved in sort of designing that, they just saw the Irish Free State was a Catholic state, Northern Ireland was a Protestant state. That's how they viewed it, and to some extent, that's the way it went. But the way I look at it is, I mean, there was no dramatic decline in terms of the Catholic population in Northern Ireland like there was for the Protestants in the Irish Free State. It doesn't mean Catholics, you know, it was a wonderful haven for them to be in. I don't think they got the best treatment they could have done. But it sort of reflects on the times, I suppose. The, you know, people came out of a situation which was very tense situation over that Home Rule period. They moved into the partition, then there was an issue about the boundaries, and so on. And I think that you can understand this sort of the barriers that were there for a period. But once you get, I think, after the Second World War, you start to say, when you look at it dispassionately, you say, well, you know, why did the situation evolve until we get to the 60s when, you know, the Catholics are up in arms, they're saying, you know, we're third-class citizens.
Yeah.
And ignoring the fact that there are also third-class citizens in the working-class areas in Belfast.
Exactly. Well, there's that element too. And there's also, during that period of time, there was even more, as well as now, that heightened sense of identity as a result of the fact that partition happened. And we all know that whenever there's a heightened sense of identity, that you tend to hyper-emphasize certain aspects of your culture and faith and so on, that maybe don't necessarily require that amount of, you know, adulation, for want of a better word. You know, it's like, I even think of the Reformation, you know, whenever there was that, when they're going on around the change in church and faith and this whole idea to just to live by faith and not by works and all this kind of stuff. And, and then you had the Catholic Church that were hyper, you know, promoting certain aspects, I think, because they felt it was under attack.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think there's, you know, there's always a danger where you have a majority situation. There's always a danger that arrogance could creep in. And I think that's something we all have to consider and think, well, did that happen? Didn't, you know, we had a minority, and Lord Carson himself warned at the time, he said, don't, you know, reach out the hand to the minority. Don't let what you feared would happen to you become what happens to them. And to me, that those were very wise words. It was very difficult, I think, in those years for that to fully get through. But I think when you look at it now, you think, well, you know, we have two very different traditions here, but everybody should respect everybody else's tradition. That's really
exactly
the core of it all.
And that, but and that also comes out of this, the idea of some of the things that we look at in our history. One of the things that Mervyn and we had touched on was this idea that, you know, the in terms of the Williamite Wars, what was going on around about that time, in terms of the idea of civil and religious liberty for all.
Yeah.
And I suppose in some senses you would say that that's, it should have paved the way for civil and religious liberty for all. But when you throw into that idea of the heightened sense of identity, that got lost a wee bit, I think, in terms of the outworking of history.
Absolutely, it definitely did. And it's, I mean, it's a standard to be upheld. To say civil religious liberty for all, then it does require certain standards, certain, you know, levels. But I think it was difficult. And there was, of course, there was, you know, we're talking several hundred years of background to all of this. In the 19th century, you had really the heightening of the idea of identity. And you had Daniel O'Connell, who was a very able and capable and astute politician, but O'Connell had harnessed the power of the Catholic Church with what was called the Catholic rent, where people couldn't afford to pay much, but they paid so much, you know, a week into the Catholic Association. But the other side of that was that Protestants started to see this movement. It was a mass movement was starting to grow, and they realized that politically, if that mass movement had, you know, got power, then they could be in trouble as a minority. And so you had all of that background in the 19th century, right up to Charles Sturt Parnell and so on too. And that's what feeds into this idea of home rule then.
Yeah.
You know, is home rule a good thing? And unions say, no, it's not. We don't want home rule and so on. So, yeah, it's a complicated history. It's a complicated
place. It is. And I think it's ironic as well. You know, the number of things that we're talking here and referring to that are in the past are actually present issues as well, you know, in terms of one of the things that I think as well from in regards to the education perspective that we have here within the Protestant community is that we have an emphasize that enough, you know, there's been this idea that the state will look after you, you know, and and you know, we can rely on it. And that hasn't been the case.
Yeah.
Whereas on the internal, I don't like using the older community, it's not, you know what I'm saying? But there's been an emphasis on educate yourself, make sure you know you're you like you're saying, know where you come from, but have a plan about what you need to be doing, because this can have a major impact. And they've had this long term strategy and goal that's been put in place, and we see it very evident today in regards to very politically astute, very politically aware, and you know, and ironically have flourished in a British state.
Yeah, well, I think so. Yes, I mean that's it is ironic in some ways, but I think that you know, that's why if there was one history curriculum, then all the students would learn the same things. So some you know, some people are very focused and, as you say, very secure in their identity and so on. But when you get to things like, you know, the 1798 rebellion, even the Home Rule period, there are lots of nuances in terms of where people are at and what their views are and so on. And it's not black and white. And I think that sometimes that there's the danger then, if one community is not educated and the other one is almost over-educated, then it becomes very black and white, because it's just you guys are the bad guys throughout history here. You've always been bad guys, you know, and you've caused all these problems. And then the people who that's been addressed to, well, they don't know. And they think, oh, well, maybe so. Or they think, well, I just know about it at all.
Exactly.
And I just turn off from it, so therefore I don't care about it. Whereas if people were learning together, they would learn about all of these things, and they would understand the different aspects that you know, that my old history teacher taught me that the one question that's the most important question in the world is why. So you have to ask why people react the way they do. What motivates them?
Yeah, what motivates the behavior?
That's a central question, and that's what makes history intriguing, because it's trying to get to the root of all of that. I think nationalist history as nationalist history, as a sort of a nationalist movement, if you like, It's almost automatic that it's going to have, you know, the bad guys in it, the villains in it, to make it, you know, they're forming effectively a history there, that things that don't necessarily fit to that history then are outside, they're out with that history, which is where a lot of Eugen's history comes into. So it's important that there's challenge.
Yeah.
In everybody's case, it's important there's challenge to what history exactly. Who you believe in.
Yeah, and that's also covering a day, because there's a real sort of, and I didn't really think I was going to get into this, but this, that Marxist socialist kind of thing, you know, of the oppressor, and also the really, there's a real emphasis at the minute in regards to the colonial history, in terms of, you know, what Britain and slavery and all this kind of stuff. And that's like being reinforced again, that if you're connected to British history or British establishment, that you're part of this colonial, you're, you know, all you do is, that's where the emphasis on planters and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think there's a danger in people putting a 21st century perspective into history, because that's very wrong, because you can't do that. You know, and the whole, I mean, nobody, who would condone slavery?
Nobody.
When you go back to the, you know, the 18th century, if you go to America, then that's what's there, that's what's happening. And to be fair, you know, Britain was one of the first countries to try and get rid of slavery.
So exactly,
I think that's a really good thing. I think that there's all the talk about colonialism and all of these things, but you have to ask then, did we bring anything to those countries? Did we bring education? Did we bring, you know, something tangible to those people? You can't write, I mean, I don't agree at all with the idea that you can write out something because somebody owns slaves, then you write them out of history. Well, you've got to look at the person first of all, and look at the background to all of that. And you know, the American Civil War, you know, it was about slavery, and it was about a number of other things too. But a lot of the people who fought in the Civil War, you know, in the Confederate side, were they were Ulster Presbyterians. They were also Irish Catholics in the southern states, a lot of whom didn't own slaves.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's so much complication to all of this. And I think if you just try and blanket it, and it becomes, suddenly it becomes, that it becomes a situation that you can't speak about it.
Yeah.
Because if you speak about it, oh, you must be, you know, ABC, you must be racist if you're going to speak it. That is, to me, is so wrong. That there has to be a really a level playing field to look at all of this sort of history. And as I say, nobody would say today, no, slavery is a good idea.
No, exactly.
Slavery still exists today.
Well, this is it. I mean, it probably exists in larger elements in certain parts of the world than it did way back in what was would have been considered to be, oh, this is the real bad period of slavery.
I mean, I think in terms of that, you know, I suppose this is a bit of a tangent about slavery. But in terms of that, you know, Belfast has a lot it can be proud of, because there was an attempt to make Belfast a slave, you know, a trade route.
Right.
And that was overturned.
Right, okay.
In the city itself, there was people like, you know, Mary Ann McCracken, there was like Thomas McCabe, and they said, no, we can't have, you know, slave ships coming in here. And that won the day. And because, you know, it won, there was a minority that wanted to bring it in. But it won the day that the majority said, no, we can't have this. And so that's something that's, and I mean, there's a statue recently to Frederick Douglass, who was a big, you know, abolitionist advocate, and who travelled around and delivered talks here and elsewhere. And that's good in itself, but I would like to see, you know, a statue of Mary Ann McCracken, or of some of the other people who, I mean, James Orr, the Ballycarry poet, who wrote in opposition to slavery.
Right,
So we should not forget that we didn't have to have somebody to come to tell us. There's a lot of people knew and opposed it.
Yeah.
So those sort of things tend to get overlooked sometimes.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think there's, without wanting to sound trite about it as well, but there's only so far you can go back and expect people to pay. How many times do you have to apologize for something, you know, in terms of that? Because the thing that really it interests me is a lot of the countries that are facing this type of approach are actually the countries that people want to go and live in, because they're the opportunities that are available to you, the standard of living, freedom of religion, or all these kind of things. And yet to listen to some people, you'd think that they were probably the worst places to live in the world, and it's just not the case at all.
No, it's not. And I think you know, societies have to come through a transition to get to where they are. And you know, that whole issue of slavery and the American states and so on, that transition had to happen before all of these things occurred. And it was a very difficult situation, still not perfect, I would say, because I've been to the states and I've seen that there's, you know, there's issues there. We think we've issues here, but I've seen the issues there too.
Yeah.
But communities have to come through sometimes certain things in order to turn around and say, no, this is what we want to have here. And I think that's, you know, what does happen in communities. Yeah, and I think, you know, in terms of our history, I think that's what could happen here too.
And we're in a transition at this point in time in our own history, although probably with us, we part of the world, it always feels like it's probably in a transition in some shape or form. But, you know, the 25 years of the Good Friday Agreement, you know, in terms of trying to, regardless of what people's opinions and stuff may be of that, that's been a transition for communities, it's been transition for police, it's been transition for education and all sorts of stuff. You know, we're finding our way with a lot of that type of stuff, you know, as well. Still, you know, integrated education and stuff. People, I love the way, you know, we call it integrated education should just be normal education. You know, everybody's been able to get in the gallery. But then that comes into your point around curriculum and being, having sort of set way of teaching things and stuff, you know, as well.
And I mean, I think that we have really effectively three systems in our education system, effectively. We have the integrated side of it, we have the state side, and we have the maintained side, and we have a small number of other schools. But those three ones are the main strands. Now, I mean, I don't see that that's going to change very dramatically, but I do see that some effort could be made to make sure people are learning the same thing in these schools. And there is cooperation, because the numbers are falling in schools, so there is cooperation between a lot of the schools now. But I think that, I don't like the idea that because, you know, somebody goes to an integrated school, that's seen as better than them going to a Catholic school or a state school. It's not, but there should be more interlocking between those systems.
I get right.
You know, that would, I definitely think would help things.
And that's something we're obviously in a transition on with that as well. You know, there's a lot of schools that have applied for integrated status. You know, my two kids both go to an integrated school, and you know, and for me, I think that's been, you know, it's been good for them in terms of, you know, when I think of where I grew up and went to school, you know, in terms of the not that the environment was, you know, it wasn't toxic or anything like that. But, you know, it was very obvious that you were getting a one-sided worldview of things, you know what I mean? So, and I think it's great that we're expanding beyond that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm quite happy as long as it's a balanced view that people get. I think that's, and as they get older, they can make their own minds up the more they learn and all the rest of it. So I think that's very important.
Yeah, no, and it's like anything that we talk about, even with our community worker, you know, there's three sides to every story, isn't there? There's your side, their side, and somewhere in the middle of all that is the truth, isn't it? You know,
so, no.
Exactly, but when we're talking about, let's try and wing it back, because we've went away, or we've been into slavery and all sorts of stuff, and that wasn't even on the agenda for this. But whenever people start looking into this idea of history, David, it can't be confusing. We've already kind of intimated that a bit in terms of where they start, and in terms of people that exist today or groups that exist today had a very, very different role in the past and stuff. Talk to us a wee bit about how we can make sense of some of that.
Well, I think it has to be looked at in the long view of history, and that's why I said at the, you know, at the start about the chronology of things is important, because if you put into the schools, you know, you drop things in, it doesn't give a chronology. So, for example, you know, you can, the Home Rule period, the debate over Home Rule at the latter part of the 19th century, you can really wind that right back to the 1790s. And particularly, in my opinion, you know, the 1798 rebellion was a pivotal event in Irish history. The first Republicans in Ireland were Presbyterians, so that's something that you're ever going to start off with. And the rebellion occurred. It was unsuccessful. And then the Act of Union came about, and the Act of Union then had you know, had certain consequences. The whole complexity of that Act of Union was that the Catholic Church bought into the Act of Union. The Orange Order wasn't very happy about it, was very lukewarm at best to it. The Catholic Church believed that Catholic emancipation would follow on the right for Catholics to sit in Parliament, the last of the old penal laws. And the Orange Order was largely, was certainly dominated by Episcopalians or Church of Ireland people at the time, and they were concerned about the Dublin Parliament, which was an established Parliament, Church of Ireland Parliament, being taken away, and this idea of the minority, becoming the minority without any real influence or power. So you had all of that at the start of it. But what the Act of Union did, certainly in the North, was it created an economic region, and that region extended across from Belfast to the west coast of Scotland and to the north east and northwest of England. So you had this whole economic union, which was part of the industrial revolution, effectively. Yeah. Belfast was regarded as the Manchester of the north. And so that was significant because everything that happened in that 19th century came down to the issue that by the end of the century, unionists in Belfast were saying, no, we don't want to have a parliament in Dublin. We're quite content with the way things are.
Sure.
And, you know, there's an author called Donald Harmon Atkinson, a Canadian author who lived in Northern Ireland for some years, did a study of Eilean McGee.
Right, okay.
And wrote a book called Between Two Revolutions. One of the revolutions was the 1798 rebellion.
Uh-huh.
And the second one was, you know, the Irish, the revolution of the War of Independence. Sure. So on. And he said that why were these people who were so revolutionary in 1798, Eilean McGee, why did they just didn't affect them in any way whatsoever?
Mm-hmm.
And he said that revolutions usually happen in unsettled circumstances, unsettled communities mm-hmm. who don't see any other way of going forward. But by 1916, 1920 in Eilean McGee, they were quite content, they were quite prosperous, economically they were very well off, and there was no need. Why would you need to do that? So That's part of the complexity of history. And I mean, I know I've spoken to people because in our community, we you know, 1798 was a very big thing at the time. There was a 16-year-old who was hanged for taking part in it. It's an entirely Presbyterian community at that stage, and it was a hotbed of the revolution. And yet, if you went to the same place today, you'll see King Billy on the wall and a mural. You'll uh-huh. see red, white, and blue. You'll see lots of flags around. So it's that transition that complicates people.
Sure.
But if they don't have the background of trying to understand all that history in school, then they're going to find it very difficult to understand it.
Yeah, outside of that,
And then all it takes is somebody to say, oh, you know, you just wanted a United Ireland back then, you know. You remove the blinkers from your eyes type.
Yeah, and it's almost like everybody switched sides, hasn't it? It's almost like it's almost there's been a side, and even the terminology that we use can be kind of confusing, can't it? You know, the idea of unionist, nationalist is very, very.
Yeah, well, I think the central part. I suppose the term Irish is a loaded term for many people, but when you look at it, at the time of the Home Rule period, the unionists described themselves as the loyal Irish,
right.
So they still use that term Irish. The decline in the use of Irish really came about with De Valera and the way the Irish Free State went.
Okay.
And his impression that to be Irish, you had to be rural, you had to speak Gaelic.
Yeah.
And
but his version of Gaelic, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. His version of Gaelic.
but that was his version of history.
Yeah.
That's what it meant to be Irish. So as time went on, people felt less and less within the Protestant Unionist communities that it didn't reflect them at all.
Yeah.
So
it was already starting to erode this sense of the identity, and that goes back to what we were talking about earlier as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Whereas, I mean, the irony of it all was it was really Belfast Presbyterians who helped to revive the Irish language, helped to preserve it as well. But by the 1930s, it was totally alien, effectively, to them.
Yeah.
And it was partly because of this idea that was very politicised in terms of what it meant to be Irish. So if you subscribed into all of that, then you were somewhat diluting being a unionist.
Right, okay. And
had an impact.
And then that's obviously where the diametrically opposed kind of political positioning starts come into play as well, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but to some extent it's been there, I suppose, you know, from the latter 19th century and early 20th century, that those sort of, you know, those stances have been taken, that people have been very much in one camp or the other.
Yeah.
Even when you had, you know, industrialisation in Belfast, people coming in from the country tended to gravitate to the same areas.
Sure.
Catholics in one area, Protestants in another. And you see that pattern in modern times.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things is, what I'd love to probably do, I know you want to, without putting you on the spot, it'd be amazing to do maybe a wee series together, you know, outside of this, because we're just hitting the general kind of themes and stuff here,
mm-hmm.
and do maybe some of that chronological stuff, David, if you were interested.
If you think there'd be an interest.
I definitely do. I think even if it being a resource for people to kind of, you know, get in on and listen to in their own time or, you know, and discuss that, maybe even having another couple of people involved in that. I think it would be a great way of just saying, well, listen, let's take it from this point and let's chronologically look at what we were facing at that time. I think it'd be a fascinating.
Yeah, well, can I also then give a plug for the long and the short of it as well.
Okay.
we're on to our 8th radio series now. Uh-huh. So there's a lot of history has been touched on, and people can still listen to that on BBC Sounds.
Sounds up, okay.
A lot of it.
Great.
And we cover lots of stuff, you know, about like the 19th century, rise of nationalism, unionism. We look at the plantation.
Sure.
Like all those areas of history. And we have academics. Rather than just me or Tim McGarry speaking about it, we're bringing people in who are academics, who respect it in their field, who ordinary people may not have read their work because it's too academic for them.
Sure.
But there they are for 5 or 6 minutes, giving a potted history of what their research shows and suggests to them. So that is something in the meantime, certainly, that people can get that on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, and it's only available on BBC Sounds, is it?
There's a new series being recorded in October, so we're looking at things in that series. But the ones that have been issued before, most of those are on BBC Sounds.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
One of the other things that I'd mentioned when we were prepping for this year was you talked a bit about, you know, in terms of bonds, the podcast grew out of this idea of promoting sort of the positives in regards to marching band culture and stuff like that. But you have a particular slant there and talking about how people who are members of bands are a part of living history or whatever. Talk to us about what you mean by that.
Absolutely. I think people sometimes you don't realise if you're in the middle of something, you know, what it is that you're in the middle of, really. It's just what you do. And I'm very conscious. If you look at bands, if you go back to the first account of an Orange parade, it's 1796. It's July 1796 from Gosford in County Armagh. And, it talks about fifers and a drummer. And that's the start of it all in terms of bands. And those bands are there particularly to lead lodges, these new Orange lodges. But there's a marching tradition that goes way back to like the Irish Volunteer Movement in the 1770s, which was a sort of a home guard almost. Time of the American Revolution. There is a strong tradition of other organisations, other fraternities, like the Masonic Order would have had parades and so on. And there's a strong military tradition, of course, which is where a lot of this band tradition comes from. I always just sort of try to put myself dispassionately away from things if I'm watching them and think, what would somebody else think if they saw all of this? And I'm just, I think I'm always in awe. And you see the bands, you see how impressive they are, the music of them, all of those things are a really strong selling point.
Yeah.
And whenever I was in the Grand Orange Lodge, we worked with Tourism Ireland and the Northern Ireland Tourist Board for what were called Flagship 12ths. And part of that was about what this actual spectacle of the 12th was offering to people.
Sure.
And it's offering an amazing thing. You know, it's a free show with all this music, all these bands, all this colour, and then the banners and the lodges and so on too. So I think, bands, men and women are part of a tradition that's been there certainly since the 1790s.
Yeah.
And they are the modern exponents of that. So they're carrying on that tradition. Maybe not, the bands change, of course, bands change over the years and things have evolved with bands in terms of instruments and so forth. And you do have, you have silver bands, you have accordion bands, you have flute bands, you have pipe bands, you have all of that. Whereas at the start, it was really like a fife and drum. And there's been a wee bit of revival in that. So certainly in our area now in recent times too. So I think people should be very proud that they belong to that tradition. And that it's very, very unique. I watched the Old Protestant Boys when they were in Savannah in Georgia. I watched some of the footage of that, and I thought, wow, that's just amazing. And I know the reception they would have got there because a lot of years ago I was involved in twinning, and a local accordion band was invited to go to the American Twin to premiere there, and they fundraised and we took them out, and the people in South Carolina had never heard an accordion band before. They were just blown over by it all. The young people were given a fantastic time with different families that they stayed with. And there was television coverage of them, there was newspaper coverage of them. So I think there's a lot to be proud about. And I think the bands community has really developed in recent years, in a big, big way. Because I remember a lot of years ago, even before I was in the Grand Orange Lodge post, there were some bands that really you would have rather weren't in a parade. That's to be perfectly honest. Yeah. But I have to say that has changed dramatically over the years. And I know that we did work with the bands community you know, a number of years, and I know a lot of the work that has gone on, and I think it's brilliant work. And I know there were bands that even had things like, you know, they were trying to do homework classes and things like that.
Yeah,
like
that's right. Yeah.
And so on. So that's fantastic. That's social work in the community.
Exactly.
And that's the big, you know.
But I think that's part of it. It is almost a part of social work, and in a sense, it's youth work to some degree as well. You know, it's a widened kind of program of community interaction. And I think that's something that, you know, I think one of the things that for me in regards to that is the language that's used to describe the band scene. Because, I mean, a lot of people outside of the band scene have got lovely descriptive language for what goes on. But for me, that whole idea of personal and social development, testing the values of belief, participation, voice, and a choice about the things that matter to you, and, you know, in terms of skills base, and also the fact that the idea of playing a musical instrument that develops cognitive abilities, develops mental health, you know, in terms of resilience and things like that. There's a lot of things that are connected to being a member of a band that are not kind of expounded upon, and almost, for want of a better word, in a scientific way to say, listen, this is what this really brings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and these bands don't appear one day a year suddenly on the street.
Yeah.
They've been practicing for months. They've been taking part in band competitions, all of those things. And I think the social aspect of the social bond is very significant, because we're in a society now where fewer and fewer people are actually engaging with each other.
Yeah.
They're on their iPhones.
They're
on social media. They have Facebook friends who probably, most of them probably
never met.
But there is a community, there's a balanced community where these people are meeting every week usually.
Yeah.
And they're taking part in parades and things like that, and they're engaging with each other. And I think there's a big potential there for those people. Those are young leaders, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, and even, I suppose, you know, because we talk a lot about, we've got young kids in the band, the future of the band. I don't really see it that way. If they're in the band, they're the part of the band now. They're not the future of upholding something, maybe, definitely, but they're an integral part of what we're doing. I see some bonds, and the amount of young people that are attached to those bonds is ridiculous. You know, and I kind of going, you go to some youth clubs, you'd be hard pressed to find that many young people interested in sitting down, learning something or doing whatever. And I just think that it just gets over.
Yes, I think it does. And I suppose it's, you know, I'm not musical at all, I have to say, to be quite honest. I was in the dummy recorder section in school. But I'm always, you know, very impressed. I'm always in awe of people that are musical and what they can do. And, you know, when you see those bands on the street, It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. And it must be such an experience for young people to get into a band that are musical and they're able to play and all of that. And some of them, you know, end up on other stages as well.
Exactly. Well, that's it. You know what I mean?
But I think that the band's community, it's growing. It's obvious. It's growing with the number of bands and the members in the band.
Yeah.
And that's very, very good. And you can understand why, because it's exciting, it's fun, it's competitive, all of those things, and it's good that it's in our community.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, we've talked about it a number of times in the podcast about it being probably, it's the largest voluntary arts sector in the whole of the United Kingdom or beyond. You know, it's like, and for me, it's like, kind of going, and that exists within a reasonably small population in terms of
people in Northern
Ireland, you know, so
very much so, yeah,
crazy, and the breadth of talent that exists there, and more people learn instruments through bands in Northern Ireland than through the likes of School of Music or even any other music development program. And I just think that's, you know, it's crazy that that's the case, and yet it's so vilified.
Yeah, and I think to some extent, you know, there's a bit of a class issue sometimes as well in communities. And I think that's, you know, having discussions about history with teachers, you know, some of them have quite openly said to me, like, you know, teachers are very middle class people. So a lot of these children, they're not interested in extra curriculum activities with them. They're not interested that they might be in bands or they might being involved with other things, you know, in the loyalist or unionist community, because they themselves are not, so therefore there's no connection there
with
these folk. But I think that there's positive things have happened in that respect in the past, but I do feel that there is this issue that, oh, you know, I don't want to get involved with that type thing. That's not my sort of thing. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that, you know, to be frank, in terms of the Catholic community, you see lots of people from the Catholic community who do very, very well.
Yeah.
And they really go out beyond their community, but they never forget their community. And I think sometimes Protestantism is, the heart of Protestantism, the core of it is about being individual, of course.
Yeah.
And I think we perhaps take that a little too far. So you do find people that get better off, they move out, and then they don't see themselves as part of that community anymore. And I think that's wrong.
David, another area that causes some concern in regards to, I suppose, maybe understanding the, in terms of the Protestant community, and what we would call our culture, where a lot of people would vilify and say that it's not culture, are things like the 11th night or and the 12th and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, these are significant cultural celebrations within the Protestant community. And there's almost a sense of, now there's a lot of things, positive things that are coming in terms of developing, how these events take place and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. But there is this almost a sense of a different type of apologetics, that we are apologizing for our culture existing, rather than apologetics in the sense that here's how we promote the understanding of these as cultural celebrations.
Yeah.
Talk to us a wee bit about, you know, the origins of some of these things that are important to why those are important.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of bonfires, I suppose, is one. I had a busy year this year in terms of bonfire talks, because I do talk about the origins of bonfires and, and the history of it. So there's been quite a number around groups that would be involved with bonfires that have had talks this year, and it's been very positive. And bonfires is a difficult thing to actually research, because there's very little material about bonfires. So I managed to find, well, the origin of bonfires is a bit of a debate over what is the origin of the 11th night bonfire.
Sure.
And the origin of it, whatever other interpretations might have been put on over the years then, I think is that the original bonfires were signal bonfires, and they were lit to signal that William had arrived in County Antrim.
Okay.
So, and they wouldn't have been, obviously they didn't have time to build great bonfires and things like that. So you're talking about like winds being used and so on. And they were lit from area to area because they were expecting his arrival. And once they knew he had arrived, then these fires were lit right across Antrim and down.
Okay.
So that is really the origin of the bonfires.
Sure.
Now, some people then say, well, they mark the victory at the Boyne, or they symbolise the campfires of William's army before the Boyne. So there's different interpretations to be put on it, but it really comes back to the fact that the bonfires were used as signals, of course, and that was a signal. It was an easy signal that was made. So that's what it was about. And the bonfires have evolved over the years. And the earliest bonfire I think I have found an account of, or bonfires that I have found account of, is from the 1830s.
Right, okay.
Now, that doesn't mean they didn't happen beforehand. It just means that's the first time a newspaper in print referred to bonfires. Right, okay. And it was actually a newspaper from Waterford.
Right.
And it was referring to bonfires in Armagh and Tyrone and Fermanagh. And it said that they were lit on the hilltops. So they were lit in Armagh and then hilltops right around those other counties. The commemorating the 11th night.
Okay.
Now, it wasn't very complimentary. It said that these people were like savages. They were breaking the silence of the night. So it's not a new thing that people are being criticized for, let's say. But for me, it was very interesting because, first of all, it gives that perspective about this impression of who, you know, these people, and this is a disruptive thing that's happened. But also it lets us know that certainly in the 1830s, this is a tradition that's there.
Yeah.
It doesn't say it's new yet. It's newly happening, so we know it's before that it started. And we don't know how soon after the Boyne that it did start, really, because we don't have accounts of that as yet, anyway. So, and I think one of the reasons, because we explored with different groups when I was doing the talk, as to why, you know, why is there not much account of the bonfires?
Mm-hmm.
And the reasoning would include the fact that if I were to take you, you know, to get some newspapers on the 13th or 14th of July, how many accounts of bonfires that there wasn't a problem with would you find?
No, absolutely.
You wouldn't find any.
Exactly.
And it's the same. It's the same situation that the bonfires could be happening. It could just be a commonplace thing. They're not being recounted in newspapers. But if something happens or there somebody criticises, then that's when it appears.
Sure.
So there's that element of it. The other element is that they're part of a bigger celebration. So they're part there, the forerunner of the 12th
sure.
itself. And everything then takes centre stage when it comes to the 12th of July with the parades. So the bonfires are sort of forgotten about, and therefore there's not much really documentation. But lastly, and I think probably most importantly, the bonfire builders are probably not very articulate. So they're not leaving notes about, about what the experience was like lighting the bonfire in 1837. Some of them probably can't write. It was sure. really an unusual thing at that time. And so I think they're a more what I would call a rural class or a working class
right, okay.
manifestation. And to some extent, they possibly still are.
Uh-huh.
But the historical record is not really there beyond a certain point. But we know the background, we know what they're about, and we know that they have continuity.
Sure.
They have come through time as well, too. So bonfires are there. People that are involved with building the bonfires, they're part of a long-standing tradition as well.
Uh-huh.
And I know there is criticism, and sometimes there's valid criticism in yeah. communities with bonfires, because the bonfire, the community should buy into the bonfire that's around the bonfire, and that's very important. And also uh-huh. the people that are building it should be conscious of their safety and all sure. those things. And in this 21st century, those are things we need to to look at. But I do feel that it's a long-standing tradition. It would be a tragedy if it was to cease.
Uh-huh.
I think it has to continue on. It may change in some ways. Some people have moved more to beacons than bonfires. But I can understand the idea of the bonfire being a bit of a social... it's a social bond as well, like bands uh-huh. being part of the bonfire building and so yeah. on too. So that's one aspect. The 12th of July is another one that, you know, that's the tradition on the 12th is a long-standing tradition. The first parade was in 1796 by what was called the Orange Order.
So that was the very first...
it's the very first parade by the Orange Institution.
So it wasn't necessarily a 12th of July parade, was it? Or
yes, there was.
It was a 12th of July parade, okay.
The Orange Order was founded in 1795,
uh-huh.
and so this was the 1st July.
Right, okay.
So there's, the account comes from Lord Gosford in Market Hill. Of the first, he writes...
Wouldn't be like Morgan Hill to have a big parade, like, would it?
Well, there you are. You see, the tradition is there. And he writes to Dublin Castle to tell them what has happened, and he describes the whole parade, which is not very different from we would describe a parade today.
Sure.
And they went through his estate and they asked permission to do so and so on. But there are other societies, and there's what's called Orange Societies, mm-hmm. which exist and supposedly they're formed by men who were in the Enniskillings, in the defence of Enniskillen, during the Williamite Wars, and they formed the first Boyne Society, and then they spread quite rapidly.
Right,
and
okay.
I remember speaking to a few of our you know, Orange historians who've passed on now, very well-placed gentlemen to talk about all of this, and I was very conscious of the fact that there's a battle in the American Revolution, and just before the battle, it's an area where there's lots of what's called Scotch-Irish or Ulster Scots settlement. And before the battle, a minister delivers a sermon and a prayer. And in the prayer, at the very end, it's all put in block letters, which suggests he shouted it or he certainly emphasised it. And there was loud cheering and so on from the people that were listening to it. But the words he uses are exactly out of the Orange Order ritual.
Right, okay.
But there was no Orange Order in 1780, of course, it didn't exist. So it's very likely we think that the ritual of the Boyne Societies came into the Orange Order
right.
After 1795, but they were already there. And I'm sure you've heard, you know, the story of the hillbilly, where the term hillbilly comes from, and so on. And I was, I have to say, I was a little bit sceptical about that, I suppose, a lot of years back.
For those people who don't know that, go into that there just for a second.
The story is that these people, when they went across from Ulster, went to America before the Revolution, they went into the Appalachians, and they took tradition with them. They took musical tunes like the Boyne Water and things like uh-huh. that, and they were called King Billy's Men from the Mountains or King Billy's Men from the Hills, and then became shortened to Hillbilly.
Right.
And that's supposedly where the term comes from. And for me, that actually was just brought... to life in front of me one day at a reenactment in the state of Georgia in the United States in a place called Lincolnton County. And I met this folk singer called Robbie Gilbert, and Robbie's Gilbert ancestors were from here.
Right.
And they settled in the mountains in the Appalachians. He lives in North Carolina. And I said to him, is there anything that has been passed down here, any folk culture that has come down? So he plays the guitar and he said, well, this tune has come down to our family and it's supposed to have been brought over by the immigrants. And he played on the guitar a tune called Lily Bolero, which he didn't know anything about. He didn't know the term of it, title of it or anything like that there. And I was just amazed. I was shocked. I said to him, you know, I know that tune. That's called Lily Bolero. That's the Williamite March. So I sent him some stuff then when I got back home. But for me, that here was the proof. You know, and myself, I was a little bit sceptical. I thought, oh, that sounds almost too
convenient, isn't
it? Yeah. But the fact that he did that, I thought, no, this is the truth of the matter here. And the fact that this man, this minister, the Reverend Samuel Doak, he exhorts them to go out to battle with these words, suggests to me that they had Boyne societies.
Yeah,
in the mountains, these orange societies that they'd formed called Boyne societies. And that's another reason why they were called King Billy's Men from the mountains,
because
this already existed. So there's so much attached to that, that even before the 12th of July parades. And then you get the 12th of July parades and going back, you know, to 1796 here, and then not far removed from that, some other places as well within the British Isles, and then across to like Canada and United States, very, very quickly after the formation of the Orange Order, you find these parades. So,
and Canada actually has the second longest running 12th of July parade outside.
Yes, it does in Toronto, that's right. And I remember years and years ago, I've never found the book since because I can't remember what age it was, but it was in the library in Carrick, and I picked up this book, and it was all photographs to do with Irish history. And I just flicked through it, and there was this photograph taken in Saskatchewan in Canada. Right, and it was just a crossroads, nothing but wheat fields around this crossroads, a few buildings, a couple of houses, and a sort of a general store, I would have taken it, in the middle of the crossroads. And there was a group of people standing. And when you looked at the photograph, you could see they were in two lanes, and there was a banner at the front.
Right, okay.
And it was the 12th of July. And I thought that is just amazing. And for me, that is, you know, that it really tugs at the heartstrings, because it says to me, you know, these people they're thousands of miles away from home.
Yeah.
But yet there's something they have from home with them that they have kept, and it's very important to them. And they're gathered out here in the middle of nowhere. I'm not sure where they were going to. Yeah. They're getting a train somewhere, I presume. Right. But, you know, that this idea, that culture has been very significant.
Yeah.
That Lincolnton County, when I was where I met Robbie Gilbert, this reenactment, there was a little shop selling baseball hats, and I went in to buy one. And the guy behind the counter says, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Northern Ireland, the United Kingdom. And he says, oh, you'll be wanting an orange baseball cap then. How do you know this in this wee rural county in Georgia, you know? So I think that all of that is all part of this big tradition.
Yeah.
These bonfires are very unique in terms of our community and our history and so on too. I mean, there are bonfires in other cultures and so on as well.
Yeah. But any idea about whenever, you know, because you mentioned there that some of the earliest records in regards to the bonfires, them being hilltop events and stuff, when that started to come down into the idea of, like, because whenever I was growing up, whenever, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Canada, that's where I'm from originally. And whenever it was like there was a bonfire in every kind of sort of area, you know, every area seemed to have its own.
Yeah.
We had one between the sort of Tower Street, Madrid Street, Beachfield Street, Westbourne Street, we had a bonfire across the other side on Newton Arch Road where, you know, there was a bonfire down by what is now Pitt Park. It wasn't Pitt Park then.
Yes.
And then you had another one over in Major Street. Lord Street had its own bonfire. Mm-hmm. And where did that all come from?
Well, I think that was, certainly that existed. I mean, it was very much more community oriented, and the bonfires would have been smaller because they were in smaller communities. But the difficulty with all of the documentation is difficult. I came across some 1950s photographs of bonfires in the Belfast Telegraph in the Northern Whig. But when you try to find information, it's very, very difficult.
Sure.
So I don't know, is the honest answer. I think a lot of these communities had a very strong sense of community from the very beginning, because people tended to come out from the country and they settled very close to each other in the same area. There's a Thomas Carn Duff, who is known as the shipyard poet. He talks about his family coming in. They lived in Drumbow. And in the 1860s, they came into Belfast, and he talks about them coming in a horse and cart and coming to Sandy Row and just stopping in Sandy Row, and that because there was lots of other people from Drumbo living in the houses all around, right. And they found a house there too. So there's a strong sort of community sense, and okay. I think that's probably where it originates. And then it, of course, evolves into this idea of this orange identity sense as well too.
Sure.
And it, I suppose it has translated over the years into bigger bonfires in, you know, areas that are not sort of localised like that anymore. But that tradition was very strong, that local tradition for many years. But it didn't help the tarmac on the streets, of course.
No, it didn't. I remember, because it used to be, you could have just walked for 5 minutes and you'd have been in another bonfire, 5 minutes you'd have been in another bonfire, and mm-hmm. all the way through, even on the 12th morning when I was getting ready to walk with a band and stuff, you'd have been walking down Taunton Avenue and you'd have walked past at least 4 or 5, bonfires that were burning out and stuff, you know what I mean? And now that's not so much the case anymore. It's changed yet again. And I think there's something that's happened in terms of the communities. A lot of people that would have been there around the 70s and 80s no longer live there.
Yeah.
They've moved away. They've taken certain things there's an emphasis on the big bonfire, the big demonstration of saying, listen, here we want to build the biggest thing that we can.
Yeah.
And not everywhere can handle that. And you'll end up with the smaller things sometimes. Yeah. And I suppose that's another part and parcel of the change. I'd love to see us get back to something along the lines.
I do think that you certainly lose something when you move to this idea of the biggest bonfire you can get, because you lose that community spirit in the local area by migrating everything into a bigger area. And a lot of people may not migrate, of course, to that.
Sure.
So you do lose something. But I suppose it's just the way, you know, things evolve, and this is how it has evolved and so on. I don't know. I think it's difficult. It's going to be difficult to sustain that idea of the biggest bonfire unless we're really planning to try and, you know, put up a rocket to the moon or something. I don't know what's going to happen next. But, you know, I think that, to be fair, some of those bigger bonfires are now worked to hold program around them. Entertainment.
Yeah, there's a lot of
that's,
stuff.
That's good too. But it's not, it's sad when you lose a strong sense of community. And I think that's, and then, you know, what happened in Belfast was that lots of people moved because there wasn't enough housing, troubles.
Or the housing that was there was replaced.
Yeah.
And there wasn't the same amount of houses moved back into the areas and stuff, you know what I mean?
Happened,
You know.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking of is I'd love to see something return back to the idea of that original, you know, purpose of the bonfire. Not that we're expecting King William to appear anywhere, but that idea of having, you know, even coming down Belfast Lough on the 11th and being able to see, you know, hilltop bonfires being lit or something. I think that would just be amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of accounts in the past for different reasons for bonfires. I mean, the Ulster Covenant, the signing of the Covenant, when Carson sailed out of Belfast, went across to Liverpool, there was bonfires lined along there and down as the Patriotic was the ship he was on, appropriately enough, as it went out towards Liverpool. So there's lots of accounts of how bonfires have been used in that sort of way.
But I would just reconnect with that historical aspect.
Yeah, well, I think that
really re-emphasise that the culture, the historical aspect.
Yeah, because I think when we talked at the start about how people don't, you know, they don't know a lot of their history, but there's a big start he made here with things like bonfires and parades, because I think there is a sense there that people have a sense that this is part of them. They may not know exactly why, but they know that it's part of them. So to develop that further is to educate people. Well, here's why the bonfire happens. You know, here's why the parade happens today, and all those things.
I just have this, I have a vision in my head of just being, you know, 1/11th night, seeing that happen, and then even having, I know there's the London at Carrick, you know, when they do that there, but even just having that, you know, procession of, you know, on that night where, you know, a reenactment of something, you know, would be absolutely
I think so, and that's the sort of thing that should be looked at into the future, because we have the facilities to do that. We have the musicians, we have the bands, we have the ability to build these bonfires with all of these things, and we should be telling our historical story a lot more. But I think we're getting to the time when we can do that. I feel that we've evolved quite a bit, and now people are asking questions. I want to know all of this, and I think, you know, there's a lot of talent out there that something like that could actually happen.
No, I think so, and I think, you know, that it would fit right nicely even in with just arts council stuff and expression and some of the funding pots that are out there.
Well, I'm just wondering if I could invite Tim McGarry to this bonfire this one you're suggesting, because he's already been up as part of our TV series, which I wanted to mention as well. He's been, I was away at the time, so I couldn't get to it, but he has been at the burning of Lundy, which is another bonfire. And so he definitely is very well educated now on the idea of bonfires. So,
I'm sorry he couldn't be here tonight. But good to have him along.
Make plans for him.
We'll end off talking about your programme, because that's probably the most, that'll be coming up pretty soon, hopefully, in regards to that. But I wanted to just touch on, you know, the fact that you were involved in the development of the museums of Orange Heritage. I think that's been an extremely positive thing from the Order over the last, you know, sort of 10 years or so that they've been around, hasn't it? And the fact you were mentioning earlier that the biggest uptake in terms of that would be the Catholic schools are visiting there in terms of trying to gain an understanding. Talk to us a wee bit about where the origin of that came from and what initially you were thinking about whenever you decided to create these.
Well, I suppose I went into that post in 2004, and we had we devised summer exhibitions to bring people in over the summer, because there's lots of people come, of course, to Northern Ireland in the summers, and particularly there's lots of, you know, Scottish Orange lodges and bands and so on come over, and they would often come to Schomburgk House. So it's the idea of trying to provide something there to be seen. So we started to do these small-scale exhibitions. There was a lot of European funding around, and I remember what one of the MEPs at that time, Jim Allister, had asked questions about why was the unionist community not getting funding and so on. So there was a combination of things happened that put it into the spotlight that why should we not apply for some of this funding?
Sure.
And to develop things much more than we had done, because we had exhibitions that really were on a shoestring, effectively. We put together, we had the help of an accountant, and basically there were three members of staff. We put together an application for, you know, £3 million project. And we got there with it. And the amount of paperwork, and I'll never forget going down to the European offices with the boxes and boxes of documents that we had accrued, because you had to really answer so many questions about how you would do this and how would you involve the whole community and things like that. And so there were lots of different elements to it. Once we got that grant, then there was a committee was set up to try and administer and develop the project, and it was really exciting because none of us had ever been involved in a museum. We built a museum. I mean, that's just something that's quite amazing. so we did that. We had people who advised us and helped us who were within the nationalist community, and that was part of the criteria that we would draw on what they would say. So we did that. We got good advice and we got good support, and everybody was very, very supportive of it. We put together then the package of what this would look like, and it was a two museum base. It was Belfast and then Loch Gaw, first Orange Warrants were issued in Loch and Sloan's Inn in Loch Gaw. So it was just an amazing thing to be a part of, because you're just so conscious of the fact that, I mean, this does not happen every day, that a new museum is created, and a museum at that scale, that size of a museum, and drawn on all of the, and there were so many different aspects that we drew on in terms of artifacts and the historical record, and getting lots of, I suppose for me, I remember the opening was amazing, because we had so many people there from different communities, and we had Mary McAleese and Martin McAleese there, and the chief constable at that time, George Hamilton, and lots of other people from across the community, and schools from across the community too. Mm-hmm. We also had we were donated an orange arch. which came
Is that the one that's out the back?
That's the one that's out the back, and that donation came at the tail end of things, when everything was designed inside. We were contacted, and the lodge in Glenarm, this was their old arch, and they said we would make this available to the Orange Museum. So we couldn't put it inside at that stage. There was no room.
Even now, you probably still couldn't do that.
There was absolutely no room, because everything was designed. But we thought, well, it should be outside where it's seen anyway, uh-huh. because that's the manner of it in the past. So so we brought it up. There was the lodge handed it over. There was a parade. They came up as a lodge, and we had a parade with them and with local Orange Men, and it was dedicated and so on outside the building.
It's a great photo opportunity at the place, I have to say.
Absolutely. So, lots of people stopping to get their photographs taken, you know, and but there was so much stuff that just came uh-huh. in that the purpose of the museum really was to try and save all this stuff, because there's lots of things out there that individuals have or that lodges have, and with the best will in the world, maybe not being looked after in the best way. So the idea was that the museum would be there for these items to come in, which they did do. You know,
but it also provides that level of education as well too, David. There's a connection.
Oh, and that's very important. And the two connect together, because like old Bennett books and things like that coming in connect, because they afford research then. So you have an academic side of it, that people come in there and they can research a lot of this material in the library. Uh-huh. And there's a wealth of good material there from the Orange tradition as well. But the visitors is the big thing, that they can come in.
Yeah.
They can learn so much. And I know now that they follow on the idea of annual exhibitions in one of the rooms then. So they have an annual exhibition every year, which, you know, follows on, which is good, because it changes the focus of it. Whereas you've got your static museum items, and then you have this other, and then there is a day, a boying day, when
that's right,
some activities and so on. Uh-huh. So all of that, you know, came out of just a few discussions that, well, we should have something like this. Why do we not have anything like this? And then how would we get something like this? And
it's went from strength to strength too, because, you know, a lot of, this is one of the things that I'd said to Mervyn as well in the previous episode, you know, for people to think that the Orange is this outdated, antiquated organization that has no relevance. Mm. If that was the case, somewhere like this wouldn't succeed.
No, it wouldn't do, no, because nobody would want to come. There was no interest to people to come and see. But there was always, I mean, before I left the post, I think we had hit over 5,000 visitors, and that was in 2015 when it was opened.
Uh-huh.
And since then, it's just gone on. Numbers, you know, have kept on going, and numbers from people from all over the world coming across to it. And, you know, your standard lodges and bands and so on from here coming to visit and so on too. So yeah, I mean, it's a real focus point. And for me, one of the big things was whenever the signs finally went up, the brown signs saying Museum of Orange Heritage on the carriage.
Well,
it's arrived now. You know, it's got that sign.
Yeah, the other thing that I like about it as well is that it's not just Belfast centric. The fact that there is another one in another location.
Yeah.
That really emphasizes the fact that there was this rural tradition, in terms of the order and stuff as well. And I think that's great, because as much as, you know, living in Belfast and people can think being here is the centre of everything, but there's a lot of rich experience outside of Belfast. And sometimes it could even be stronger than what it is in Belfast.
Yeah, well, I think, yes, absolutely. There's a very strong generational connection outside of Belfast. And you can see that, you know, on the 12th day when you're watching the programme and you listen to people being interviewed and so on, there's a very strong generational aspect there that, for different reasons, doesn't exist in Belfast as much, because there's been a lot of dislocation in Belfast, families and so on moving away, and the links not being kept with lodges and so forth. But I think, you know, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it is a rural organisation.
Mm-hmm.
It was founded in a rural community, and it spread very quickly in rural areas. Now, it also spread into the city, and part of that was probably people coming in from rural areas.
Making the change,
And it's, I mean, the Loch Gall Museum is excellent too, and it's got that sense of history. We always believed that at the start, that this is where the first warrants were actually signed and handed over to people. So that's the building that happened. And so that's
a strong, there's something, there's a connection sense. That I actually find that I feel a lot more of a connection in that one than I do in the Belfast one. The Belfast one's great.
Yeah.
But there's something about being in that building.
Yeah. I think that's a bit of a selling point of it, that history really happened in that building. Whereas in the other building, we've brought the history into the building, and you can see it.
Yeah.
It's the most fantastic collection of stuff. And there's other smaller museums in different areas. I was involved in Limavady with the Orange Centre there, and they set up a similar small museum of their own. And they have some amazing artefacts too, and such a strong heritage and tradition up there as well.
It's like Brownlow House as well. You know, Brownlow House, you know, lots of those.
A number of those places. And I suppose these are the focus points, the Belfast, Long and Loch Gall is the Museum of Orange Heritage, and the others then are able to sort of follow on because they too have lots of artefacts and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
At the time, we were a bit concerned that there was so many artefacts out and about. The main thing is that they're all safe. That's the important thing, that those artefacts are safe and they're well looked after. And, that concerned me that, you know, because I knew in my own area, in our own lodge, which goes way back to 1829, that the secretary, when he died, he lived on his own. His sister lived beside him. They lived in two houses, side by side. And one of the members of the lodge went down a few weeks later to see her, and she was out in the back garden burning a lot of books from his house, including minute books. So, you know, I thought, oh, this is just, she's been clearing out the house, and, you know, and that's what's happened. And that happens all too often.
Exactly.
So that was certainly one of the drivers, because I thought that's history that you can never
get back. Yeah.
Never get that back. And there's such a resource within the Orange Institution in terms of names. You know, there's at least probably a couple of 100,000 names that are in minute books and rule books. And lots of people used to write in, you know, from America or Australia looking for details in family history. And none of it is, well, very little of it is digitalised.
Most of it is still
held by lodges. So that is an issue in itself.
It's crazy. It's hard. It's mad to think that, you know, that maybe somewhere along the line, some of the things that you would be looking for in regards to connections to the history and, you know, things that would verify stuff for you have potentially been thrown out, buried, burned or whatever else over the years.
Yeah.
And there's this sense of you really don't want to lose anything. It's
very sad when you think of things like that being lost, and it happens all too often. It happens for a lot of reasons, and maybe people clearing houses and they just don't have room for a lot
think
of stuff
about it,
and all of that.
Listen, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about the TV show and stuff. Obviously, you've mentioned a bit that you were doing this on radio.
Yeah.
And is the motivation in terms of that this has been popular on radio that it now is meriting a TV version?
It's been very popular on radio. We've had seven series, and we're going to record the eighth radio series in October time. And there's been lots of good feedback from people, good listener figures and so forth. And I think the formula of it works quite well, because it's Tim and I are from different communities, so we have different views on history. So we'll have a bit of a bicker about it. We do bring in experts to try and referee the situation.
Right.
But it's all done. It's the good humoured and very respectful way of doing it. Since series five, I think it was, some comedy sketches have been introduced as well.
Right, okay.
Comedy sketches. So with that background, it was felt that, this could make the transition to television. Lots of people have said, it should be on the TV. Lots of people have said to me, you should be doing this in schools, which is a different proposition.
Yeah.
Very difficult to try and work that one, but we can now get on the TV. And I know that some schools do listen to the radio, episodes on BBC Sounds.
That's okay,
depending on what the curriculum is, they'll listen to that because they're very good information. So hopefully the same thing on TV. It's been a different discipline, I suppose.
Sure.
Radio and TV are very different.
Oh, yeah.
So it's been, Tim's well used to all of that side of it. I had a small experience, I suppose, with TV, but it was an experience. It takes a lot longer to produce a TV program, but it has the opportunity is there for people to actually see what you're talking about.
Sure.
So they can see where history happened. You know, we're doing like Lundy we're discussing was Lundy really a traitor?
Right. Okay.
We're doing that, so we're up on the walls and so on. We're in the Apprentice Boys Museum and so forth too. We're looking at the Larne gun running, so we're in the sites that all happened.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Collins, was he a hero or a villain? So we're down at a place called Beale na Blaa where Collins was shot.
Okay.
And we're looking at the Act of Union. So we're in Dublin at Trinity, and we're in the old Parliament in Dublin, which is the fantastic wall hangings of the Battle of the Boyne and the Siege of Derry.
Sure.
Still in the building. So there's that element that people can actually see this now.
So then the idea behind this is that you're looking to unpack like a balanced view of some of these issues or events?
Yes, well, I'm always up for a balanced view. Tim?
Who said he's not here, so we can't.
You may listen to this. I'd better be fair. No, I mean, both of us have a real interest in all this history. And we sort of come from different perspectives. But we bring academics in then, so we have our bit of banter about it, sure. And we bicker about the thing and raise questions. So we bring in these academics that will give us their impression. And the idea is that we'll answer that question at the start of the program is quite a crucial question, because all this is potentially contentious history. Uh-huh. So, you know, we look at the for example, the Act of Union. Would you have voted for the Act of Union in 1800? And the Act of Union, a lot of people probably don't know much about it from 1800.
Sure.
But, I mean, Tim set out with the idea that he wouldn't have voted for it. Of course, he wouldn't have voted for it. But the reality was that the Catholic Church supported it. Uh-huh. And so by the time we had finished, he thought he potentially could have voted for it at that time. Coming from a Presbyterian background, I would have reckoned yes, I'd have voted for it, because it took away the Dublin Parliament, which was what's called an established parliament, sure. The Church of Ireland, and it levelled the playing field a bit more. Uh-huh. So, and if I'd been Church of Ireland, I probably would have said no, I wouldn't have voted for that, because that's done away with our parliament. So there's all those sort of nuances, and then we explore all the backgrounds with these academics to try and reach some sort of consensus then. And, you know, Irish history is, it can be contentious, but it's also fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's so many aspects to it. So we try to bring that. And I think the very important thing is that we come from different sides of the community effectively over it, but we're very respectful in terms of how we argue and bicker with each other. So the message is, you can have these arguments and so on. You can come from different communities. It doesn't mean you have to fall out with each other.
That's it. It's about having the conversation.
Absolutely, isn't it? Yeah. And that's very important.
Yeah, no, and I think that's something that we could probably learn a lot from, is about, that just having different point of view or having a diversity of opinion isn't a bad thing.
Not at all.
It actually enriches community as a whole stuff. So when's the TV program on?
Well, it starts at 7:30 p.m. on a Friday night. The first Friday is the 8th of September.
So in a couple of days.
And after that, the four programs will be on the iPlayer once the first one.
Okay. Should be able to watch all four.
Binge watch as much as you want.
Is it Netflix of Irish history here?
Well, some people have described it as the horrible histories from Northern Ireland. We've been described as a number of things in the papers this week in terms of the History Boys was one of them, and it was in the Irish News today, for example. So it's half-hour programme. It's coming on after the one show.
Right, okay.
So it's a good time for it to be on a Friday night. And hopefully we'll get the viewers and people will be really interested and learn a bit from it.
Well, I definitely have to watch it on the iPlayer, because this weekend I'm up in Londonderry doing the William King's 55th anniversary concert. I'm comparing up there. God knows what that's going to be like, to be honest with you. Okay. Their ways letting me loose on an audience there. It'll be interesting.
Well, we were up there doing what I call stand-up history.
Right.
Doing the Lundy at the Wedding City Festival. It was
Festival is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I have to say, I went up and spent a few days with some of the guys in the Northwest Cultural Partnership up there, just around the walls, the characters on the walls and stuff, and then they actually took me in. Been in the main hall loads, and they took me into this part way down in the depths of it, and where they found these original sort of barrels and stuff, and inside it was hidden in this part of a wall that was hollow and stuff, they found these cannons and stuff, and inside the cannons were guns and stuff, it was crazy, that this building is just full of absolute mad history. But it was absolutely amazing. One of the things that we've seen that need, and I suppose people have heard me not talking about it here, but outside of anything, that's the Solace Highland Dancers did a performance that night, and they did almost like an interpretation of the siege through dance. Brilliant. And I don't think I've ever seen anything like it in my life. Yeah. It was unbelievable. It was like standing ovation stuff in the game. Just ridiculously good. But that's a group of people there who have taken a hold of their history and looking to present it in relevant format.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the creativity. It does exist. It's there. Yeah. It's just a matter of tapping into it in many different ways.
Exactly.
Brilliant. So we'll enjoy the iPlayer if you watch
it. I will indeed. No, I'll definitely be making a whole... I'll be definitely... I'm going to make actually do is try and find some on sounds, and when I'm on my way home tonight, I'll put that on the car on the way back and listen to some of that stuff, because it might give me some ideas. Or if you're interested, maybe doing a wee series that's specifically aimed at maybe the marching band community in history, which would be great.
The folk listening give you a bit of feedback.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, folks, if that is something you'd be interested in, leave a comment in the comment section and let us know whether that's something you'd be interested in. And maybe we would do it in wee small half hour, wee bite-sized pieces, because some people can't listen for hours on end. I have no problem with that at all. I can live, if there's something I'm interested in, and make a time to get into it. But David, thanks very much for coming in and speaking to us. I'm sure there's probably loads that we were looking to talk about, but I think, we've given a really good overview, I think, of some important aspects there, so I appreciate you coming in and sharing with us,
Not at all. Nice to be here.
Folks, hope you've enjoyed that, and I know I found it absolutely fascinating. Listen, I could probably stay here for another hour and we could talk on more, but I mean, you might need to get home, David,
where's the popcorn?
But folks, make sure, if you haven't already, if you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you give the video a wee like, make sure you subscribe to the channel. Subscribing is free, it doesn't cost you anything. All it does is it makes sure that the more people who like and subscribe to the channel, then YouTube, its algorithm will kind of push out our content to people who are interested in this type of thing as well. So it just helps promote the channel. Join us again next month when I have no clue who's going to be on, but you're going to love it anyway. So until the next time, folks, look after yourselves and take it easy.